It started off, didn't it? It was the first breakout after the war.
Yeah.
There was a great anti-feeling of everything, you know.
That's right.
And the most important thing was to get as much past the BBC censors as we could. And we used to stick... like the soldiers laugh. You see the sailors laugh at certain jokes and the soldiers laugh at certain jokes. Yeah. Then came the civilians. That's when it got tough.
We have to embarrass Pike by pointing out how old he is. We were all Python fans. We were 15 or 16.
Or right? Goon fans, you mean?
I'm sorry, Goon fans. So things are interchangeable. Yeah. You did 1984, Spike.
Yes, we did.
And you got a good review in Punch. And I ran into my father bearing the review, you know, and saying, "You see, it is good," because of course he couldn't stand it.
Really?
Said it was a lot of rubbish. All the things that get said about us.
And my father liked it.
Did he? Yeah.
My mother didn't. She hated it. And my mother was Python. She only likes the bits that I'm in.
Goonpod. Originally, this podcast was going to be called Harry Secombe, Lust for Glory, but wiser heads prevailed, thankfully. I'm thrilled to welcome back to the pod, Joel Morris.
Hello, hello, hello. This is very exciting. What a nice thing to be asked to come and do.
I'm trying to think, is it probably the most talked about British comedy film of all time?
It's something ridiculous, isn't it? I looked it up this morning and it's something like it keeps turning up at number one on best comedy film polls. Like this, but the big ones, like the BFI and the AFI, it turns up as like this is the one that everyone really, really says is the to be the best comedy film. I mean, that's quite a hard thing to claim, isn't it? I can see why people rate it as the best, because I think it's an astonishingly clever mixture of all the different things you might expect from a comedy film. A lot of comedy films are like very warm or are full of good character work or great stories. And some of them are full of great gags. And this is a pretty good be a base of anything you'd want from a comedy film. It's got as many stupid gags as Airplane, but it's got a nice warm plot and nice characters. And it's got sort of an Ealing farce in it. I think it's a good, most of the things you're in the mood for in a comedy film, this will give you. So maybe that makes it rise to the top. And it's got something to say. So slowly, if you did a mass poll, slowly more people would find something they liked in it than if you're not a fan of rom-coms, you might not put When Harry Met Sally at the top. But this, I think everyone would agree, at least it's definitely funny and it's definitely a good story and it's definitely groundbreaking and makes you think.
Yeah, I was trying to think of, I don't think there's any comparable film which has resulted in so many acres of coverage, newspaper coverage, television exposure, because of its quote controversy or controversial elements.
And maybe that's why maybe I probably don't rate it as highly as I might otherwise. And I do really like it, but I'm always wary of comedy that's interesting because everyone's talking about it rather than comedy that's interesting because everyone's laughing. Luckily, it is really funny as well, but to sort of insist that this is a really good one, very significant because everyone debated it. You go, yeah, the best comedy film would be the one that maybe will laugh the most, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because you can get debate by writing a polemic or an academic textbook or a drama. I'm always a big fan of things that comedy uniquely can do. But I think that's what's brilliant about this is it does ask questions, but it does it in a very acceptable, very warm way. And I think maybe that's why I get shocked about the reaction to it, as in it's clearly angry, but also puppyishly silly. And it draws its teeth by being so silly. In a way that says, we just want you to think about this. It is a court jester. It's got a bladder on a stick. It's it's poking fun. But I don't think the weird way that people went, I don't think you can poke fun. And you went, have you never been to any comedy at all? Have you not sat in a classroom and watched pupils mock teachers? I mean, it's one of the most fundamentally simple comedy shapes it can be, which is to mock the powerful. I mean, it is pretty honourable and pretty old as a form. And it's very funny when the king goes, I can't believe that man with the bladder is doing that. He's been doing it for a while. we've been here before. We've definitely seen this. I find that's generally, I think it is great. I think it's its place within the tradition is astonishingly cool. I think it's good, as in this should and could and was made thousands of years ago. And yeah. I'm glad we still make them.
Absolutely.
At our best.
You mentioned classrooms. I mean, there's a recurring kind of classroom framework running yes. through this film.
Yeah,
we'll come
definitely.
To that, I think. But 45 years ago, as we're recording this, I don't think I've mentioned the name of the film yet. The Monty Python team were filming Life of Brian in Tunisia. Yeah. Literally this month, I think September, October, November, 78, wow. they were filming. And it qualifies for Goon Pod simply because blink and you miss him, but there's a small cameo, quite a memorable one, by Spike Milligan.
Yeah.
And he's only in it because he just happened to be there at the time. And they said, come and spend a morning filming with us. But before we start talking about the film in proper detail, Joel, obviously, you've had your own podcast going for what now? About 18 months, 2 years? Comfort Blanket?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That's coming up for, yeah, it's probably 18 months, I think. Yeah, yeah.
And it's essentially people that you like, friends of yours, people that you admire, coming on and talking about comfort viewing, comfort listening, comfort reading, whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's things you go back to again and again and sort of never let you down. On the basis that usually that means they're quite good. Yeah. If you ask people to name something good, they debate it for a long time. You name something that you keep going back to and keep finding new things in or makes you feel happy, then you're accidentally naming you're secretly naming your favorite thing, but you're not being forced to make a top 10 of the most worthy things. You're just saying, actually, it's Goonies or Friends or ABBA Gold. It makes it easier to get a straight answer out of people.
And I think I asked you this last time, you know, are you always in alignment with your guests in terms of liking the stuff that you talk about? And I think you said you can be quite selective about what you choose. So you're not going to choose someone that elects to talk about, I don't know, Mein Kampf or something. It's got to be something that you yourself admire.
There's a formal thing in that what's comforting to listen to, which is why I only found this out for a while. What's comforting to listen to is people agreeing, which is why Goon Pod's lovely. As in, no one's going to come on who hates the Goons and rip it apart. Hmm. And broadcasting got very combative in the last 10 years and it's full of people debating stuff. And I used to do this as a job, as in you'd come on and be a talking head and they'd say, you get invited onto Radio 5 to say that you hate the Da Vinci Code with someone who loves the Da Vinci Code. And that was broadcasting. And that was apparently balanced and also exciting broadcasting. And one of the things that's lovely about making Comfort Blanket is the two people involved have agreed this thing is good and no one's going to take it down. At worst, I won't have seen it or read it and it'll be new to me. And there's a few of those who had, which I thought, but I bet I'll like them. I hadn't seen The Goonies before Ingrid Oliver suggested it. It was a film that I was the wrong age for. And I loved watching it. And then you're watching it and seeing what someone else sees in it and imagining them as a child. And it's an incredibly nice thing to go, oh, I'm too old for this. But my God, I could see why a 12-year-old would have loved this. And that's a really nice bit of an exercise in empathy. But yeah, so most of the time it's things I do like. And otherwise it's things I think, oh, I missed that. But I'd like someone to make an advocate's case for it. And I won't choose something I know I'm going to hate. Because that's just bad. That's bad podcasting. It's good radio, apparently, but bad podcasting, I think.
Absolutely. And it was a year ago that we last spoke, just over.
Right.
And at that time, you were right in the middle of writing Be Funny or Die.
Yes, which is coming out in March. I've delivered the edits. It's gone off. So that's done. I've got to promote it in March. So we'll see what happens with that and what the response to it is. I've had a lovely response so far from anyone who's read it. So hopefully... Brilliant. That will extend to other people as well. So yeah,
well, I can't wait to receive my copy.
Oh, hurrah!
Because you were agonising. I think you were working on it either as a sequence or even a whole chapter, analysing an episode of The Simpsons. I think. And
I did that, and then I binned it because it was too. It was the wrong thing for the book. Otherwise you could just do it. I realised you could do it for absolutely everything. So I originally wanted to do analysing an episode of The Simpsons and ended up analysing 2 minutes of it and then thought, hang on, if this is the shape of the book, then people will go, right, what are you doing next? 40 Towers. and it felt like it was a good exercise in proving my point that you could increase the enjoyment of comedy by really breaking it down. But the great thing about it is that was where I started off from, and the joy of any project is that by the time you finish it, and it was about 4 years' work writing Be Funny or Die, by the end of it, I'd found out so much and learned so much. I was thinking about comedy in a completely different way. And it was much clearer. And it didn't involve having to analyze every single joke, how it worked. There was, by the end of it, fingers crossed, there's a more general thing that you can appreciate the shape and weight of jokes and go, oh, that's how that works. That's why I'm laughing. And it's actually quite a nice thing to find out. And it's only like the analogy I keep using is it's like stage magic. You can still be impressed by a magician's astonishing skill whilst also knowing they're only doing about four things. But what you're watching them do is do those four things spectacularly. There are only 12 notes in music. It doesn't make music shit. Or Western music anyway. But yeah, learning what the chords are doesn't mean you no longer can ever listen to music. And it's basically that analogy going. Knowing that a great card magician is sticking the cards between his fingers and up his sleeves and things, that doesn't mean you don't go, wow. And it's eventually ended up being, it's a book that says, actually, what you're watching is a bunch of dazzling misdirections and things, but basically
sleights of hand,
based on a few very, very good sleights of hands that human beings love having done to them. It's basically being tickled. All the comedies is being tickled, and we love being tickled. But the problem was, as our tribes got bigger and bigger, people were beyond arm's reach, so we had to make films. It's as simple as that.
Rewatching Life of Brian for this, there was a couple of sequences that made me think, the Simpsons have been influenced by that bit.
Oh yeah, I think it invents a tone and an irreverence and a rhythm that is hard probably to appreciate again watching it now with Python, I think, because it went in so deep. Ditto with the Goons. It's hard to imagine a world before them.
Yeah.
So I think that the real risk with watching Life of Brian again now for what must be the 4 millionth time for me was to take it for granted. And I had to shake myself up and go, imagine you're watching this for the first time. What do you think? You may know Monty Python. You may know that they're irreverent, and you may know their styles. But what would you think if this was the next Monty Python thing and you hadn't seen it before?
Okay, great point of entry here. So can you remember the first time you saw it?
Yeah, I think like most Monty Python, it existed, because I'm that generation, down the video shop.
Yeah.
For a long time before I saw it. And it existed as a playground myth a long time before I saw it. Because it was a 15 certificate and hard to get. I mean, right into the video era, a lot of video shops wouldn't stock it because of the controversy. Yeah. It was labeled as such. It looked dangerous. It looked a bit Sam's Dad. My parents liked Monty Python, but were cautious about giving it to me too young, even though I'd seen some of the TV shows. I think the first film I saw of theirs was Live at the Hollywood Bowl, which I just adored, just because that's the first time I'd seen those sketches.
Yeah.
And that was from the video shop. And then I went, okay, if we've had that, can we go to the next one? And I had younger brothers, and they knew I would show it to my younger brothers. So there was a slight worry about, well, it might be okay for you, but if you start showing these routines or repeating them to your kid brothers, is there going to be trouble? So I remember watching the Hollywood Bowl and then Holy Grail, I think. And then Life of Brian was my third. But by then, I knew all the sketches by Playground Rumour. I knew what happened in The Meaning of Life by Playground Rumour. And I knew stuff that was in this by Playground Rumour, none of which turned out to be in it. But it
well, had you heard the soundtrack, the LP?
Good evening. Tonight's motion picture is the thrilling story Monty Python's Life of Brian. Set in North BC, it tells the story of the life of Brian and stars 70 camels, 48 goats, 16 chickens, 12 pigs, 2 dromedaries, and of course the wacky Monty Python boys.
So basically, I knew the soundtrack and I had the book, the Monty Python's crap book, which is currently sitting on a shelf right about within arm's reach. I can reach it now, I can touch it now. It's still on my shelf, and because it's a beautiful artifact to find out how the film was made. Mm. And that was, I was obsessed by anything that showed you how things were made, whether it was a behind the scenes Star Wars documentary on the television or a script book like the Goon scripts that showed you what it looked like written down. And best of all, with Monty Python, they'd show you what they cut out. And I think if you're a writer for a living, you learn pretty quickly that writing is just editing. And then you find out that everything you love used to be worse. Deleted stuff will be the stuff that didn't fit. And then you go, oh, so there's a sculpture. It's you've got a big block of marble and you chip out the bits that aren't Monty Python's Life of Brian. Some of which might be really funny, but when you imagine them back in the film, you realize they wouldn't work. And the Monty Python's crap book, the script book for Life of Brian, had all these bits in it that were totally different, that were more like the TV show. Same as the Holy Grail script book did. And I think I learned a lot by just looking at that. And then when I finally saw it, I knew some of the sketches from audio. Mm. And I knew some of the sketches from being written down. Yeah, it's a very strange world, that pre-video world, where video was hard to get, where you would often know something by reputation way before you got to actually see it. but you'd studied it.
You'd studied it, yeah. Okay, I was a bit like that with the Goon Show scripts, because some of those scripts I read before I heard the shows. And
yeah, yeah.
And listening to the shows is almost a bit of a come down in some respects.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're imagining. I mean, I said this to someone recently. I'm a big Doctor Who fan. I love Doctor Who. Loved Doctor Who as a kid. I don't like Doctor Who anywhere near as much as I imagined what Doctor Who would be like to watch when I read the books from the library. Because the TV show is just it's a low-budget British children's programme that hasn't had enough money spent on it, tragically, because it's great. Whereas the books were like Star Wars. They were in my head. They were absolutely spectacular. And I think someone was saying how great a friend of Katie Brand, who's a huge Red Dwarf fan, said the best form of Red Dwarf is the novels, because you imagine what it would have been like if they'd had those ideas and but the biggest budget in the world. And I went, yeah, that's a lovely way of looking at it. Sometimes the version of ripping yarns off the page I love even more than the TV series, which I love a great deal, but I love the version that was in my head when I read that book in the library and imagined this beautiful adventure movies with an enormous budget that looked like Indiana Jones or the Battle of Britain or something. These huge Guy Hamilton, epic boy's own adventures. And on the TV, they're really good. But in my mind, they were incredible. And I think, yes, Life of Brian was in my head first before I saw it. But I think the great thing about this, probably why it is regarded so well, is it doesn't let you down that much. It does look really beautiful. It is beautifully achieved. It is the closest journey from the page to the screen that I think Python ever had. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, because I was trying to think when I first saw it, because I'm, you know, I was a child of the 80s. And
yeah.
But where I grew up, there was very limited. I think there was one video, maybe two places in the town that rented videos. And me and my best friend, we used to rent out Holy Grail all the time and just watched it over and over and over. I honestly don't think I saw Life of Brian until I was living in Belfast in 91, 92.
Wow.
And it's around that time Channel 4 broadcast it. It was broadcast on British TV for the first time, I think.
It's stunningly late, isn't it? That's the thing. Yeah. I think it still felt like it was filed in my head for some reason, even though I knew Python were to be trusted and I knew they were outrageous, so I knew I was going to expect. It was filed alongside Clockwork Orange and The Exorcist as a thing I read about how it had caused trouble and been banned. And this is right in the middle of things like Video Nasties and Driller Killer and all that nonsense, the very Mary Whitehouse-y moral crusade. It was all linked up with that. And there was a feeling, if I bring this into the house, is this the one that's a step too far? So I felt it was an extremely dangerous thing. And I didn't sit and watch it with my parents. It's not a film I know, even though my dad was a Monty Python fan. I didn't sit and watch it with him. This is definitely a thing that belonged to me alongside Spinal Tap and things that, and the young ones that were mine, rather than a thing my dad had said to sit down and watch. So I'm definitely, this is one of the things that maybe that makes it special, is that this definitely belongs to me as an outrageous thing I was into as a teenager.
Well, see, my dad would have, my dad was a bit of a, what's the word? Not heretics too strong, but he was very anti-religion. He was Northern Irish, and he was quite anti all that sort of thing. Yeah. And and he loved, I won't say he loved Python necessarily, but he loved the Goons and he loved irreverence. But I know that I would not have been able to watch this film with him for one reason. He would have got a lot out of it, but he was quite quite prudish about certain things. And just like I wouldn't be able to watch The Shining with him. There's obviously some forefrontal nudity in this film.
That's all it takes, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also, the other thing is, if you watch it privately, I remember thinking this, that lovely thing where if you're watching it privately, you know that your parents will walk in exactly at that moment and then walk out and think it was an hour and a half of that.
Yes.
So I remember happening with, I think my parents walked in at the Trogs tape bit of Spinal Tap and assumed all it had been was swearing for an hour and a half. And I went, no, that's just the sweariest bit. How did you know when the swear? I think they were waiting outside the door for the sweariest bit to walk in. But yeah, your parents will walk in the moment that, is it Sue Jones-Davis is naked? They'll walk in at that point. But the whole point is these are very naughty boys.
Absolutely.
And so they will make a film that contains naughty things. And time will then be either kind or savage to them for doing it.
Hello. I've been asked to read this prepared statement on behalf of the Monty Python boys, who are here on location in North Africa. Unfortunately, they have been so spoiled by success in show business that they are now too rich to speak without being paid enormous sums of money. Also, for tax reasons, they're not really here, so stumm. However, they would very much have liked to talk to you, had you been able to afford them, especially as they're now making a film in Tunisia, which obviously they'd like to plug, as it's costing nearly $4.5 million, which is the sort of money these boys need now before they'll speak.
So this film, originally they sort of bandied about a few ideas, and they thought about having a 13th disciple called Brian.
Yes.
Was he late for the Last Supper?
Yes, the idea being, yeah, his wife would have other plans of people around and things like that, which is a very Python TV show idea.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to go, let's talk generally about this. I think what's great about the film is the decisions of what they decided not to do.
Mm.
When you hear about them, they're those great things where someone's, we had this great idea about so-and-so, and you went, yeah, the craft of this film is that you went, you didn't go with your first idea because that's weaker than the final idea you had, which is more interesting, more human, kinder, less flippant, and has deeper resonance, all of it, which means that you can then watch this film. And even, again, maybe this is the achievement of this as a comedy film. Even when you can see all the jokes coming and you've probably exhausted, you've sucked dry your joy at the performances and the direction and things like that, there's still stuff to think about in this film because they didn't go for all the laziest jokes or the sketch show jokes. They went for jokes that are, most of them, 10% deeper than that. So there's something to get out of it beyond the jokes, and the jokes are still there. And I think the 13th disciple idea is nowhere near as good as a man is mistaken for the Messiah at exactly the moment that would definitely have been happening. That is a, if you want to know what the hallmark of the Pythons are compared to almost every other sketch group, is that they thought harder. That's what the university comedians were meant to do. They were meant to be clever boys and then be naughty.
Well, I guess there were six of them to enforce quality control.
Yes, well. And also that quality control was based on, well, they're Oxford and Cambridge. They're showing off their brains.
Yeah.
That's how they got to be together. At every point from leaving whichever schools they went to, whether they were like Jones coming through grammar school and showing off to achieve, they've achieved by showing their brains off. And by the time they get to the example that's been set for them by, say, Peter Cook, and this sudden wave of, we talked about this before with the Goons, the wave of, post the Goons, you get a wave of middle-class comedy writers and university-educated comedy writers that come in after that wartime influx of demobbed comedy people. And suddenly those people go, well, we should show off our brains. That's what we've always done. And so they do the research. They read up. And the argument, which always made me angry with its injustice when I read about people criticising it, was that these people who wrote this film were cleverer than the people who were criticizing them, because they'd actually read up the theology and read up the history. The Pythons had done their homework, which meant that then their naughtiness was completely justifiable, because they went, this was happening, and we've set up a beautiful framework here where Jesus is parked beautifully over to the side, visible in full view, no criticism of Jesus, but some incredibly human criticism of how people respond to that. It's so clever.
And yeah, and now, to my mind, there's at least three, possibly more, points in this film which make it very, very clear that it's nothing to do with Jesus. It's not about, Brian is not meant to be Jesus. And you had, obviously, I wanted to avoid talking about Malcolm Muggeridge and the Bishop of Southwark. Yeah. I wanted to avoid that.
Kind of, let's not, because they don't deserve it.
No, they don't. But
They haven't thought about this film either as hard as you and I or the Pythons, so that we can dismiss them.
No, but they famously missed the first, 10 minutes of it?
Yeah.
So obviously, so they missed the bit right, the pre-credit sequence with the wise man getting the wrong stable.
Yeah.
Which makes it very clear.
It destabilizes your view of the film, is what it does. Effectively, you now have an unstable view of the film. No, it sets it up and it says, whatever's going on here, this is what's funny about it is a really good basic. I mean, the fundamental comedy joke is, while something's amazing is going on, what are the other people doing? It's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, by Tom Stoppard. Yeah. It is medieval margins, which obviously fascinated Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam. The people in the margins of the thing, the people who are in the mud while the king goes past, is the Python's fascination is, while something is going on, other people are distracted or have got their own obsessions or are trying to stop the story happening or are getting in the way of it. They are absolutely fascinated by the rude mechanicals who are in the way of the heroes. That's who they dress up as. Mm. And the idea is that the story is going on just to the left, and the story is going on just to the left exactly as it would always done. And now we're over in the margin of the manuscript, seeing all the antics of the things and the animals and the people are pooing out of windows. And that is, to be honest, most of Python is about that. It's where they find their jokes, and it's bathos. It's while the greatest story ever told is going on, here's the other one. It's the second greatest story ever told, the one next door. They're always in flat B to the main story, and that's what happens in the stable. The stables are next door to each other. Someone makes a mistake, and it tells you, okay, this now means we are not demeaning the core message of the story. We're gonna just play around in its margins, which is great. I mean, because I like Python so much, I ended up doing myth at college. I did lots of medieval theatre, I did lots of Arthurian myth, and lots of I studied that. And these jokes are in there all the time. Mm. They are absolutely, while heroic narratives are told, there's a bit in the Chester Mystery Cycle, the York Mystery Cycle, where the carpenters are building the cross. And they're criticizing the work. The Carpenters Guild did one where they criticized the build of the cross because it was really shoddily done and it would have upset Jesus because he was a carpenter. And that's a joke that Idle and Gilliam suggested for this film. And it's 1,000 years old.
Wow.
And it's just, I go, okay, so that was done as a religious festival. So the idea that somehow the churchman went, this has never happened before. And he went, it used to happen in a wagon outside your cathedral because it's a really good joke.
Yeah.
And if you let the ordinary people tell jokes about the culture you've given them, which you've only let them read one book, they'll make jokes about that one book. And I'd say that the thing that's fascinating about Python, and you said about school and the school setting and the classes, the thing all these boys had in common was they'd been to the same sort of schools.
Yeah.
So they'd been told these stories. They were told King Arthur, and they were told stories of glorious war heroes, and they were told the Bible. So when they all sat down and said, what stories do we all know to take the piss out of? They were just the same as a medieval guild. I went, well, we know the story of Jesus. And then the naughty thing is, shall we scribble all over the Bible? Should we draw cocks on our divinity textbooks? What this is singing rude words to a Christmas carol. It's while shepherds wash their socks by night is what it is. That anyone was shocked that this would happen or could happen is insane, because that means you've never been a school teacher. Or you've never been a pupil.
But yeah, I mean, look, obviously you've got a very cinematic sweep at the beginning, post-credits.
Lovely, lovely Jesus. That matte painting. Oh,
we see Jesus from afar, and it's Ken Colley.
Oh, sorry, you meant the after the credits. Sorry, yeah, Ken Colley. I meant the matte painting. The three wise men arriving is Jesus.
Oh, that, yes.
And that also
so cinematic.
Let's make a point. That says we are taking the piss out of Hollywood epics, so you know what the rules are. So any joke they do will now be funny. If they started small, it wouldn't be funny. They start huge.
Yeah.
And the moment that you pop Terry Jones doing a pepper pot into the middle of that, you know it's the wrong person, the wrong place. The joke is really clear. There's no doubt that the three guys who come to visit are from a Cecil B. DeMille film and that she's the wrong person, the wrong place. And therefore, wow, there's our joke for the rest of the film. So that opening shot, the map painting, and then the opening sweeping shot of Ken Colley that says, here's Jesus, here's the Zeffirelli version you've just seen there. Off we go. It's beautiful.
How blessed are the sorrowful! They shall find consolation. How blessed are those of gentle spirit. They shall have the earth for their possession. How blessed are those who hunger and thirst to see right prevail. They shall be satisfied. How blessed are those whose hearts are pure. They shall see God.
And also, I picked up on the fact that the brilliant, and it's a slight sketch, but it's the ex-leper. It's Palin as the ex-leper.
Yeah.
He specifically says that Jesus cured him.
Yeah. So Jesus' miracles are real. Yeah. Palin looks, Palin's ripped as hell. Whatever Jesus did worked.
Yep.
God Almighty looks good. So you see Jesus, you hear about Jesus, and Jesus' power is never questioned.
Never questioned. Absolutely. I'm just trying to think. You know, you say about right at the beginning, it is like a Cecil B. DeMille. It's sitting out at stall right from the beginning. I'm trying to think. I mean, I've seen Holy Grail countless times, but the DVD begins with the opening of the film Dentist on the Job.
Yes. Yes, that sets its stall out very badly. No,
but is that different on the... Was the cinematic release, did that have a different beginning?
No, it just opens properly. Dentist on the Job's...
Right.
They bought the rights to an old Bob Monkhouse film and just shoved it on the front of the DVD. That's a great joke. But yeah.
Very disconcerting.
But it opens as a proper Hollywood epic. And again, that's the thing they learned with Holy Grail, is when they replaced Neil Innes' score with a off the peg, heroic DeWolf score. It said the setting of this has to be utterly realistic for us to pull these jokes. And it's the joke they were doing all the time when they did location shots in Flying Circus, was it has to be a sweep across a real hillside. We have to really go to Scotland. We can't do it. And we talked about it with the two Ronnies, with the Phantom Raspberry Blower. You need to spend as much money as possible on the film bits for the film pastiches to work, because otherwise they look like sketches. And the joy of this, of Terry Jones's direction on this, is he's reaching for, with every penny he's got, to set up the joke for you, which is, this is a Hollywood epic, and then we'll throw people in who get in the way of the story going properly.
and Gilliam, obviously, I won't say he was sidelined, but he wasn't given the opportunity to co-direct, but he got his own bit, didn't he?
Yeah, he gets his own little bits. And he also, again, lovely map painting work. I still can't get over how good the map painting is for when Brian's written all over the forum.
Yes.
That's such a good map painting. I worked out this time around, it must just be a piece of glass that Gilliam's painted the graffiti on, but it is seamlessly good. It's Powell and Pressburger good. It is such a good special effect. It's full of those moments, and they all... Gilliam's right, as in you have to spend time and money on this, but they all sell the reality of that place, and it then means that it's very rare within this film that they break the reality of that they are in 33 AD. You can count them on the fingers of one hand. You can, stylistically, they talk like modern people, but when Bigger Sticker says Spencer Tracy, it jumps out because you're like, oh, actually, hang on, that's someone he couldn't possibly know.
Yeah.
All the rest of them you can believe. It does feel like you're there. It is real, and you're allowed those silly jokes. It's fine. Then none of them really break the reality, but the reality of the world is 100% real. It is possible that aliens would visit 33 AD. That's absolutely fine. If you've seen Prey, you can do historical science fiction. It's fine. It doesn't break it. And it's a rule that Palin and Jones used in Ripping Yarns, I think, that the world is utterly real to the people inside it. There's no attempt to break the fourth wall like they would do in Python. They're very strict to themselves. They build this world and it is solid. And I think it makes the jokes 10 times as funny.
The spaceship scene does take me out of it slightly. Okay.
Yeah, probably a huge mistake, but it's funny.
But I love the fact that the attention to detail extended to... We know at Chapman's battles with the bottle. And potentially, or initially, there was a thought that Cleese might play Brian, and then Chapman quit the bottle, quit the booze, albeit, I don't know, temporarily or whatever, but got into shape. And but the alcohol was kind of a crutch, I believe, because he found it quite intimidating appearing in front of people performing. And yet he was quite prepared to strip off bollock naked in front of 100 extras. But the attention to detail extended to having to wear a rubber band around his old chap to achieve that circumcised look.
I mean, he's a doctor. He knows this stuff. It would annoy him if he saw it. I mean, Chapman legendarily would get his John Thomas out for any reason at all and slap it on the bar.
He
was a legendary slapper of penises on bars. I think part of his way of coping with nerves was sometimes that extroversion that comes with it. It's like camp extroversion. He knew it shocked people. So I think he was one of the people who didn't mind getting naked. But that attention to detail, that's great.
Yeah.
He knows it will show up on camera. It's going to be huge on the screen. He wants it to look good. He's showing off. He's obviously very happy that he's in shape. He's very happy that he's performing well. He is terrific in this. I mean, everyone, this is probably, unarguably, them at their peak performance-wise, all of them. They're all brilliant in this. They're at just the right age. They've just escaped from the shadow of Python enough, all of them, to have a little bit of success, and they're all very happy with themselves. It feels slightly less competitive sometimes than Python can feel. They're all enjoying each other's performances and enjoying each other's company. It's got a lovely collegiate feel. And maybe some of that is down to Graham being well. And them not carrying someone who is making them vulnerable, because he was obviously, I imagine, quite a weight, especially for Cleese. But everyone seems very happy. Cleese seems to be delighted to be given his headmaster parts, which he's brilliant in. His sort of failing authority figures, which he plays a lot of the way through this. He's great.
Yeah, I mean,
voices in the background.
The high priest that he plays in the stoning scene is basically faulty, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, they're all headmasters. If you look at this, the thing they can all agree on is they all know the story of Jesus because they learned it at school, and they've all been at school. Look at the stuff that's got taken out. Most of this is jokes about teasing authority figures. It's guying teachers. It's someone going, spit it out, spit it out is the thing, or it's group jokes about groups of kids getting together and going, we're not being friends with him. It's all understandable. I think it's one of the reasons that it's a grown-up film that was a 15, that if you watch it when you're 11, you get all the jokes because it's like school. There's no joke in here you wouldn't get if you were an 11-year-old, because it's about authority and behaving in front of the teachers. They're in an occupation, and people's behavior within an occupation is like people's behavior within a school. There's someone who could get you in trouble, and you have to behave. And I think a lot of the time, when you get to things like Romane Zite Domum, which is doing lines, mm-hmm. he has to do that. He's doing Latin. I go, well, all these kids would have done Latin at school. Still works as a thing, even if you never did Latin at school. You understand the teacher's making him do his homework again. But all of them, you look at it for the first 52 minutes, I counted. The first 52 minutes before it gets into, which is the shift where it starts talking about religion. It has 52 minutes about occupation and then 40 minutes about religion. It's a split. It's great. Mm. I mean, God, it's clever. But the first 52 minutes, it's jokes about being somewhere and being naughty, which are totally accessible. And then 52 minutes, it throws some philosophy in and then coasts out on an absolute high of really answering some serious questions. But there's very little religion until 52 minutes. The rest of it is all lovely review sketches that you could do at school because they're about school and being told off and getting in trouble. It's totally accessible. Its core joke is headmasters going, who threw that? It's just that. It's so clever.
Yeah. And I like the fact that they're quite prepared to take the piss out of the 70s left wingers, I suppose, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah.
Unions, factions.
It's got something in common with, because it's 78, 79, it's what it's got in common with Hitchhikers, I think, which is the same era, and also Alien. These artifacts that come out about 1979 that are all about union unrest, and they're all about blue-collar disputes, and they're all about how bad councils and forums and bureaucracy and out-of-control committees are, because that's what's bothering their writers. These were all written in the era of strikes again, faulty. They're all that. And they've got that right through them. They're all about blue-collar unrest. Because it's all pre-Thatcher, before she just put all those people in a capsule and
throw them
in space. Mm. So it's what's going on. And plus, years of Baader-Meinhof and unrest in the streets and terrorism. All of that's in there. It's very 1979, the first sort of 50 minutes of it.
The first blow has been struck.
Did he finish the slogan?
100 times, in letters 10 foot high, all the way around the palace.
Oh, great. Great. We need doers in our movement, Brian, but before you join us, know this. There is not one of us here who would not gladly suffer death to rid this country of the Romans once and for all.
Well, one.
Oh, yeah, there's one. But otherwise, we're solid. Are you with us?
Yes.
From now on, you shall be called Brian, that is called Brian.
Terry Jones had said when they were editing Holy Grail, there was a point, whatever they put it, he said that it's something between 50 minutes and an hour, people didn't laugh. They kept rearranging the sketches because you can make Holy Grail any order. He said people are tired of just laughing at nonsense. You need story, plot and character at 50 minutes. And 50 minutes is exactly when Brian falls into the place of the prophet and has to talk his way out of it. And suddenly, again, watching it as a writer, I went, Brian's not had much of a character up till now. That's the moment he blossoms. You hear his voice for the first time. It's the moment that Brian appears in the film properly. He's been bobbed around by Reg and Mandy and other people to that point, Judith, pushed around. He suddenly speaks. And then you get a brilliant 40 minutes of what would happen if you let Brian become the Messiah, which is sort of the Mistaken Identity Ealing film that's buried in this sketch film. But it kicks in at 52 minutes, and then it has some amazing stuff to say about false prophets and need for faith. But up until then, it's kind of a lovely, well-crafted sketch film, but it's sort of about nothing, apart from maybe rebellion, insurrection. Also, it's about unreasonable demands, which I think is what's a lovely thing. It's about people who want to change the world and they're just going, well, it has to change tomorrow. And there must have been a lot of that about, between the sort of the hippies and the 70s and the trades unions and all that unrest. There were people just saying, we demand the world change tomorrow. We demand the complete dismantling of the Roman Empire by that thing. And within that is the now problematic Loretta scene, which if you read it within that context, isn't problematic because it's about people making demands they can't possibly make. Because it's not a scene about trans rights. It's a scene about a man asking for something he can't possibly have and then being told by his friends, you must be able to ask for anything. because that was after the 60s, the belief was you could ask for anything. All bets were off, no authority. Which again is fascinating. I think it's looking at it as an artifact of its time, that little film that runs up to the first 50 minutes is about what it felt like to be around in the 70s. People just demanding they be heard.
Yeah. Loretta, by the way, is that a nod to Marty Feldman's wife, do you think? Or?
It has to be, doesn't it? It has to be. Eric Idle's thought of what's the most sensual name I can think of. Marty and Loretta are obviously so in love that it's obviously a little nod to it, sort of saying that I don't just want to be a woman. I want to be fucking Loretta Feldman. That's who I want to be. And again, probably a little in joke for Idle to say, I'll make an impossible demand. I can't be Loretta Feldman. That's an impossible. I was watching out for the problematic bits, which they're obviously because we've moved on. It's an old film now. But then reading them within the context of what the film's actually about, they're less problematic and they're also less. But Cleese will look at them and go, we can say whatever you want to. And you're not saying whatever you want to. You're cleverer than that. You're saying something to do with the themes of the film. So you're allowed to be on the edge of maybe some dodgy stuff. The speech defect stuff is pretty, apart from Idle's jailer is sort of inexcusable to have to double down on speech defects.
Yeah.
But I think the two Roman leaders are absolutely allowed because they're jokes about the king's speech. They're jokes about having authority, demanding respect and wielding authority without the basic tools to get that authority. If you're going to say you're an amazing orator, which is what Pilate says he is, he's commanding, he should have oratorical skill, and he stumbles over his words and people can't understand him. And Palin was a stammerer. He knows that. It's done with empathy. He's a very empathetic character, Pilate, I think. He's been given authority, told he's in charge, and doesn't really have the clout or the ability or the skill to wield it. He's a classic weak, he's an I. Claudius character, a weak emperor character. And that, I think, is represented by him having a soft R, which is regarded as an effete upper class thing. So it's saying, okay, he's walked into a high rank, a high wank, and doesn't have the respect of the people he's demanding respect from. I'm saying you're allowed to do a soft R joke then, because that's better thought out than you just going, ha ha, he can't speak, which is the joke with Idle's jailer, which is a bit meaner. I think that's punching down. I don't mind you punching up at the guy who thinks he's a great speaker and isn't.
Just on pilot, was Incontinentia Buttocks ad-libbed?
Don't know, it's just brilliant.
It seems to be, doesn't it?
It's also, I was watching it going, you get the laugh on Incontinentia, don't you? And I think Palin's expecting to get the laugh on Incontinentia and realises that no one's quite heard what he said, so he pushes it. And the piece bursting out on Buttocks, it does look, I hope it's not second take. Or maybe it's a second take and he's had to put Buttocks in there to get the laugh. But, that's a joyous thing. And you can see him biting his cheek when he's up against Chris Langham, trying not to make himself. And it's, so what you're watching there is an extended riff.
He has a wife, you know. You know what she's called? She's called Incontinentia. Incontinentia Buttocks. Shut up! What is all this? I've had enough of this.
Did you notice as well with this, there are a lot of long takes. One of the things that Terry Jones is great as a review director, there's several things working in his favour. He does long takes, so he allows his friends to do their routines and not make it in the edit. It's not talking to some people who'd worked on those sort of Judd Apatow, Paul Feig, improv films. And they do lots of single shots of people's faces so they can cut. They'll improvise 40 lines, like you see at the end of Anchorman, 40 lines and then pick the best two. There's none of that in Brian. He films everybody acting together like a review group. And he's got widescreen. He's got 16:9. So he can put on TV, you can just about get two faces in. Very often just one face in 4:3. In 16:9, you can put three people in a row. You can have Nisus Wettus and the jailer and Gilliam's jailer in a row and have them all react to each other. And then he achieves the cuts like animation or a cartoon by cutting frames to speed things up.
Yeah.
You can see there are moments where Mandy falls over too quickly or there's a quick cut.
Yes.
John Cleese is always jumping in the frame and they go, doesn't matter, we've tightened
the beat of that
joke.
Is that what it is? Right, okay.
Yeah, he'll jump in the frame and you'll go, what he's done is he's lost half a line. Are we all agreed? Right, we're all agreed. And there'll be a jump before we're all agreed because someone went, I, and it slowed the thing down. And Jones is a masterful, obviously, writer and pacer of comedy. And he's gone, if I need to take out, I'm not going to cut away, I've got no coverage, I will cut within the frame, I've got everyone set up, they've done a brilliant sketch like you would do on stage, and I'll cut within that. And if you go, it jumped then, and you mind, you're an idiot. because I want to speed up the Roman soldiers coming in and out. I'll undercrank.
Yeah.
Because this is comedy. The rules are Buster Keaton. We just cut within the frame, and I don't mind any of those. In fact, they give it a liveliness, and they give it a silent comedy, a sort of Hal Roachy feel to it. It's bloody great. I love those. It's not carefully assembled. It's beautifully rehearsed.
And I know, obviously, when you say at that 50, 52-minute point where religion kicks in, and obviously they're casting a cynical eye at organised religion, and or how easily people can be fooled or choose to be fooled or misinterpret, in Brian's case, misinterpret banalities. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, is the same being applied to a degree, or maybe to a slightly different degree, to the PFJ, People's Front of Judea?
Yeah. It's people looking for simple answers.
Yeah.
And looking for an easy way out. And I was trying to work out what the philosophy of the film was. I'm going to get pretentious now. I'm going to go absolutely off it. I'm going to warn you. I'm going to go off in. Because this occurred to me this morning. I went for a bike ride and went, oh my God, I think I felt like Donald Crowhurst on his mission. I thought it's in the face of God.
Oh yeah, wow.
I'm clutching the ship's clock. I've written It Is the Mercy in my diary. And this is my mad theory about Life of Brian. It's about not looking for, I was about to say, it's like, what I've always thought about it is it's about not looking for easy answers.
Mm.
And then it occurred to me today that what the film's about is it's about not looking for stories. It's about not looking for heroes and shape and finishing. And what Python learned from Milligan, and why I thought about it, because I was thinking about coming on and talking to you, Python learned that shape and narrative and story wasn't everything. And what had happened to Spike Milligan is he'd gone to the war and nothing made sense. And he came back and said, I'll make a series of shows where there are epic narratives. We're going the quests and we're doing war films and we're going to find the last of the whatever and we're going to go up the mountain. All that stuff that Python borrowed from the goons. But they're not going to make sense. They're not going to start. They're not going to finish. And they're nothing will make sense. It's Lewis Carroll. It will just be Hunting of the Snark. Nothing will happen. And what Python took from that is they said, well, we'll get rid of narrative and shape. We will stop demanding punchlines. We'll stop demanding the ending of sketches because that's boring. We're forcing the crazed whimsy of our brains into shapes that are fake, that we don't trust. And then they have to go and make films. And the first thing they find is that you can't make a film with those values because you need a story.
Yeah.
And they struggle to do it. So what they do is they borrow stories. It's Quantick's observation. David Quantick's observation is that the Oxbridge plot is someone else's story with your sketches strung along it, whether it's Sherlock Holmes. And that is basically The Goons as well. It's someone else's adventure. That's why the Scarlet Capsule works great. It's Nigel Neal's story with goon nonsense.
Yeah.
Arthurian quest. What are the people looking for in Python films? Let's say there's three Python films. They're looking for the Holy Grail, which is the meaning of life. They're looking for Christ's message, which is the meaning of life. And they're looking for the meaning of life. It is a quest for meaning. And the quest for meaning, the problem with having a quest for meaning is that you will find that meaning in story. And what happens at 52 minutes in Life of Brian is that just as you're thinking, there isn't really much story to this. It's just, they're just chasing Brian. He's got in trouble and they're after him. And at 52 minutes, he lies and he starts telling a story.
Mm.
There were two servants. Well, what are their names? They're called Simon and Adrian. He's making it up. He's trying to be saved by telling a story to some people who want a story. And he doesn't tell the story. He goes, but, and he runs off and they go, tell us the rest of the story. What people are after isn't religion or a messiah. They're after a story. They're saying, if you start telling us a story, we will keep listening. We want to know who the murderer is. We want to know what happens next. What are their names? I think is the key line in Life of Brian. It says, people are always looking for answers and story and sense and narrative. And the reason the ending of Life of Brian works, when you pull that Python trick they pulled at the end of Holy Ground, said, there's no ending. It ends up with he's nailed up and four people come to rescue him and all fail to. So you go, well, we've set up all that's the story. The story is he gets rescued. That's what happens to Christ. He gets rescued. There's an ending. And off that rescue of Christ, you can base an entire religion that Christ didn't just die on the cross is how we get Christianity. Brian just dies. And what the Pythons are saying, the most dangerous thing they're saying about religion is it's just a story. Mm. And if the story ends like our story ends, like it ended for everyone else up on that hill, if it ends for them, there's no meaning to life. And what all the followers are looking for, what Reg is looking for with his martyr, what Brian is sort of looking for, is what am I here for? Why am I here? What am I here for? And the answer is, you're not here for anything. Life's a piece of shit. It's the same as the universe song in Meaning of Life. The answer is, the Python answer is, narrative is bullshit. There is no story. There is no ending. There is no punchline, because it's just a load of nonsense. It's silly, and humans are silly, and we don't have any purpose. And if you are the Bishop of Southwark and you're about to take them to pieces on a TV show, you should have taken them to pieces for that. Because what the Pythons are saying is the only hope we've got is to abandon hope. Stop looking for a story. And that is why Python is funny, because it says, this is just mad. The world is just mad. And that's what Milligan said. He'd been to war and he came back and said, the world is just mad. And the moment you accept that we're all meaningless actors who are just blundering about and making stupid mistakes, and the guy who picks up the cross gets nailed up and Brian's mistaken for Messiah, people out there for the wrong reasons, there's no story there. The story Christ had, where he gets saved by God and has a superpower, that's great. You can base a religion on that. You can't base a religion on Brian dying on the cross for no reason.
No.
It's an astonishingly clever bit of philosophy, but weirdly, it's the Python philosophy, which is that story is bullshit, and why they and Milligan struggle to make films, because they don't believe in story. They take years to start believing in story. They always want to pull the rug out from under story, because it's what you learn when you're teasing your teachers. This doesn't make sense, sir. It's that impulse.
Yeah.
I don't believe your story. Your story is that, if you take it apart, the Christ story doesn't make sense. He can't suffer as a man and then have a superpower that gets him off dying, because then he's not a man. The only thing that makes humans men is the fact that we know we're going to die. That final song in Life of Brian is cleverer and more honest than the message of the Bible, which is why it's an insidious and dangerous artifact.
Wow.
I think that's why they got upset, is that the story then went, life's a piece of shit. Yeah, I think that one's true. And I was brought up religious, and I have plenty of time for people who have faith. But you should also have room for the Python creed, which is, this might just be a load of random shit. And your insistence that it follows a story, which is what the followers are demanding. they're taking random patterns, like he's dropped a gourd, he's dropped a sandal, and saying, well, force this into a story. And they force him to a story, and he gets caught up in that story and he gets nailed to the cross. And their one, I know this and I followed a few, their Messiah doesn't have a good story. He has a shit story. The story next door is the greatest story ever told. This one is the one that most of us live, where at the end of our lives, it makes no sense at all. It's an incredible piece of philosophy.
Yeah.
And it struck me this morning. But it genuinely, I think it's inherent in every Python sketch, is that it won't really, there's no story, there's no plot, well, there's no shape.
Yeah, because it occurred to me watching it this time round, because I hadn't thought about it until you sort of examine these things more closely when you know you're going to be talking to somebody about them.
I wouldn't have thought about any of that unless I thought, I've got to talk to you something. What does it mean? And I went, I've just enjoyed it before. There has to be a meaning, otherwise I wouldn't keep going back to it.
I mean, I took it, I accepted that a lot of it was bunches of sketches that were just strung together with a linking storyline of sorts. But you mentioned Milligan. I mean, the weakest part of many Goon shows was the end, because it was just very much a case of, will this do? The climax is, we've got to save him. And then someone says, but they didn't. Good night.
Oh, yeah. You they know. Do that. Isn't it the Red Fort where Neddy gets shot? He's coming. He's going to rescue him. And I went, this is how Life of Brian ends, is that everyone's coming to rescue Neddy at the firing squad, and they all turn up and then fail.
Yeah. And I was thinking, because it didn't occur to me until this time around, how would they, because the song saves them. The song is a great ending, but how would they have ended it otherwise?
I don't know. I thought that today, and I thought what it is, it ends on a note of uplift, but a note of uplift that's borrowed from a different Hollywood idiom, which is musicals. And the thing that's funny about that song is it is unearned. At the end of Greece, where they go up into the sky in the car, it's completely earned. You go, oh, they fell in love. It's brilliant. Oh, I'm feeling so uplifted. They're going to take off. And so they can sing the big song and you go, hey. At the end of most musicals, your final number is earned by the journey you've been on.
Mm.
And the joke with this, because it's a joke on saying narrative is bullshit. The final song in Life of Brian should be like Leonard Cohen. It should be just bleak. It should be just terrifying. And the fact that this is uplifting, classic piece of Idol sort of review, 30s review whimsy, it's a song from a different film where the message has been, And then the lyrics are the message. Weirdly, the melody is from an uplifting musical and the lyrics are from this film. And this film has said, your life means, is only meaningful to you. There is no greater narrative. You have no greater purpose. The people who are following you, the beautiful thing, God, it's beautiful, about celebrity or anything, is people will project onto people what they want to see. Brian is a blank canvas. That's why he's not really in the film for the first 40 minutes and why it's so funny that he falls down, he replaces another prophet and then fills it with some stuff he's half heard. I love that it's half heard stuff from Jesus. So he's already a follower. He's just misquoting Jesus. There's a lovely, he's like one of those guys who wrote down the bad quartos of Shakespeare. He's overheard it and has done it from memory.
Yeah.
So he's borrowed Jesus' things.
Chinese but that's whispers.
And that's enough for the people to go, oh, so you're quite close to the story then. And that's a great joke that he's been at the, oh God, it's just occurred to me. He's misheard all of Jesus' stuff because he's too far back in the crowd.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning.
Speak up.
Everyone is passing on the Blessed of the Cheesemakers version of it. And that's the version he delivers secondhand. A lovely point about how most of Christ's teachings came to us through books written 100 years later or via Paul. There were people who said they had the story. Paul is basically Brian. He's someone who was there at the time and has some secondhand knowledge. Actually, Paul wasn't even there at the time. He's a bloody Roman soldier. The versions we have of Christianity are written down by people who were near it. And we went, please let these people have the secret. Let them have the rest of the story. I want the rest of the story of Simon and Adrian. What are their names? That is the demand that we have as people. We want the rest of the story. And as storytellers, the Pythons have always felt the funniest thing is to say, there is no story. Hunting of the Snark, it's just a boojum. There's nothing really there. We'll stop it. And Life of Brian, because it has some philosophical weight behind the idea that if you look for narratives and easy answers and heroes and villains and revolutionaries, you'll find them wherever you want to put them. Your need is greater than their ability to provide. That Life of Brian's lack of narrative cohesion doesn't bother you because actually it's what the story is. The story is don't look for a story. Because if you start looking for stories, you'll start following the wrong people because they will just tell you stories. Because stories and myths are how you, flags and nations, bad stuff happens with persuasive stories. Narrative is dangerous. It's dynamite. Python's disrespect for narrative is at its best in this film because that's what they're writing about, I think. So I think that's why it succeeds as a great film rather than just a load of sketches.
To them only shall be given.
What?
Shall
be given what?
Oh, nothing.
What were you going to say?
Nothing.
Yes, you were going to say something.
Oh, haven't I finished?
Oh, no.
Oh, come on, finish before you go. I'm not going to say anything. I've finished. No, what won't he dare? He won't say.
Is it a secret?
No.
Is it?
Must be, otherwise he'd tell us. Oh, tell us. Leave me alone.
What is the secret?
Is it the secret of eternal life?
Won't say. Oh, of course not. If I knew the secret of eternal life, I wouldn't say. Leave me alone.
Just tell me, please.
No, tell us, Master. We were here first.
Yeah, we were here first.
Mark, go away.
I can't
go above Mark.
Is that his
gorge?
We've got the secret.
Yeah, but
it's under offer.
This is his gorge.
Ten.
It is his gorge. We will carry it for you, Master. Master?
He's gone. He's been taken up. Oh, he's been taken!
I mean, Joel, I knew you were going to bring profundity to this conversation, but
I don't know if this is true. It's what I felt watching this, and I felt watching it this time because I think for the first half hour, I know it so well, I'd stopped laughing. I was just enjoying the fact that it was familiar. And weirdly, I was going to say, why am I watching this? What's great about this? And suddenly I went, oh, hang on. I think there's something behind this that's hanging together that makes it. And of course, the moment I realized I wasn't laughing, I went, don't be stupid. And then started laughing again. So I was watching it with an academic, like I'm going to come and talk about it, brain on. But weirdly, there was loads to think about at that level, which may be why it's their greatest, why Cleese, certainly who's the analyst, regards it their greatest film. I think it's the most, weirdly, their next film, The Meaning of Life, attempts to answer the same question as this. But the reason it's slightly inessential, they'd already answered it. And that, I think, is really tragic, is that they tried to do it again. They did a quest for the Holy Grail, and they did a quest for the meaning of life, and in the middle of it, they found their own answer, which is that you shouldn't look for the meaning of life. You shouldn't look for stories. There isn't one. And again, it's 78, 79. What does Douglas Adams say? you can't find the meaning of life because you don't know what the question is. The problem is you're looking for a meaning. And it's amazing these two great comedy things come out roughly the same time that have lasted, that still have fans and still are read and enjoyed now. And they're saying sort of the same thing. That, and Arthur Dent and Brian are similarly, they're passengers within bigger stories. They're at the side of a space epic.
They want a quiet life, really, don't they?
Yeah, they both do. They want to be left alone, and they want to. And Brian goes, "Well, I should be looking for more, so maybe I should become a rebel." But
then So when you see him meeting the PFJ at the Coliseum, he's naive, he's impressionable, and he just wants to join because he sort of fancies one of the members.
Yeah, the reason anyone does, don't they? Isn't that what?
People,
God me. I had a brief involvement with the church as a teenager. It's because I quite liked a couple of the girls down the youth club.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason people get into religions, isn't it? Or cults or political things.
I ended up agreeing to act in a panto just because I fancied one of the women.
I think it's why people join revolutionary movements. Yeah, Baader-Meinhof is just full of horny German teenagers. I love that. It's done quite nicely as well. I think there's a sweetness around. It's quite odd. I think if it wasn't the Pythons as a cast at this age, Brian could be played by a much younger person and it would work really well. He's played as a sort of naive. He's done. That's why Chatton's so good. He sells you the fact that he's very, very innocent.
Mm.
And he probably should be 10 years younger for this story to work. He should be more of a sort of a teenage ingenue, but much more condied, much more sort of a naive.
Yeah,
and innocent. But he's sold as an innocent brilliantly, I think. And that's to do with the performance. You don't think of him as a man in his 30s or 40s. He's got a lovely simplicity to him, an openness to him. And that's what he gets taken advantage of. And he gets bobbed along by history.
And
he has to be 33, doesn't he? He has to be. Sorry, that's the maths.
The bit at the Colosseum where he's selling the wolf's nipples and otter's noses. I'm sure I'm not the first person to draw this comparison to the albatross sketch.
Oh, yeah. There's a great thing of why this film works is you've taken a thing which a Python sketch would be someone wandering through with the wrong thing on an usherette's tray. That's a lovely joke. But they then say, okay, this thing that's on the usherette's tray is a comment on the fact they can no longer get food they like in an occupied territory. Lovely. Great. Well, that's why the PFJ are there. Everything makes sense. It's very solid at putting Python nonsense within the rigid reality of the world because it's all telling story. And it's all telling you why these people are like it. And I think, again, it's another reason why it works. It's nonsense is in all the right places, which is a skill that, again, sometimes Milligan didn't have. They've learned from Milligan. And they've applied. The thing that Python are is they are rigorous and they've applied a rigorous logic. They had 40 options and they chose the one that made sense. The nonsense that made sense is brilliant.
Did you get any echoes, as I did, probably wrongly, of... So the bit with Palin chained to the wall in the prison cell. Did you get any echoes of the Four Yorkshiremen sketch from that?
Oh, yeah. And there's lots of that in it. There's lots of that. You can hear in it, in all good Python, the archetypes they're playing with are totally recognisable to the audience.
Mm.
So that's someone's dad at Christmas. That's your right-wing dad who votes for things that don't help him. They've all got lovely analogues with ways of thinking that you recognise that would come usually. It's funny as well, when they go through their writing process, the stuff they agree on and usually get through is stuff that's about stuff, what it was like at school, what it was like to be in a gang of kids at school, what it was like to be with your parents, mums and dads. Palin's amazing at people in councils, small town bureaucrats and things. He's brilliant at the kind of people you meet when you go to apply for a parking space and things. He's boring people.
Oh, well, in this, you've got the what I call the Open University prophet.
Yeah. Oh,
who's the boring, God. Who's the Eric, what's his name, from Ripping Yarns.
Oh, Howard Molson's new shovel. Oh, God, rumours of things going astray. I think the pan across the prophet
is
one of my favourite sets of noises that the Pythons ever make. As in, there's just one of them, I think Gillian's one was meant to be Keith Moon originally, and Moon didn't turn up. But I love it being Gillian.
But he was dead.
Yes, of course he didn't turn up because he was dead. That's why. I mean, that's incredibly lazy of him, very unreliable. See, I'd forgotten that. I was about to say he was drunk. He's not, he's dead. But yeah, it was really, but it's much better than it's then. But the noises they make, the sense of the love of language and sound, because they've got that. I always love their stuff when they're doing a school assembly, a thing they're all familiar with. They all went to the same sorts of schools. So that sort of rubbing linseed oil into the school cormorant. This is a religious thing. This is, oh God, you are so big. This is religion. It sounds like religion. They've heard this. They've listened to this gibberish, this nonsense in divinity lessons. And there's the nine-bladed sword. And you go, oh, this is just the gibberish from Sunday school.
The sword shall be huge and black, and the eyes thereof red with the blood of living creatures. And the whore of Babylon shall ride forth on a three-headed serpent. And throughout the land shall be a great rubbing of pots.
The demon shall bear a nine-bladed sword. Nine-bladed, not two or five or seven, but nine, which he will wield on all wretched sinners just like you, sir, there. And the horn shall be on the head of
Hebadiah, his servant. There shall in that time be rumours of things going astray. And there shall be a great confusion as to where things really are. And nobody will really know where lieth those little things with the sort of raffia work base that has an attachment. At this time, a friend shall lose his friend's hammer, and the young shall not know where lieth the things possessed by their fathers that their fathers put there only just the night before, about 8 o'clock.
It is written in the book of There's something Cyril. Stephen Fry is very good at as well, is just taking out the shape of Vivian Stanchel was good at the shape of speech and filling it with gibberish. Lewis Carroll, it's a lovely thing. But that pure nonsense of those prophets and the idea, again, astonishingly true and brave, that you will gather the crowd round you who are looking for answers, and the answer, and the guy, the boring prophet, won't have a big crowd, and at the end of it, the beautiful thing as well, Brian gathers the biggest crowd because he doesn't finish, because he leaves a gap. And that's how storytelling works. It's Scheherazade. You will get people to follow you if you say, I'll tell you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And everyone else has got answers, and Brian leaves them a question. And it's just brilliant. So they go, tell us more. And you go, oh, that's how you do it,
It's kind of like populist politicians.
100%. If you provide an answer, you'll gather certain people. But if you say, I will constantly be teasing you with more.
Yeah.
There'll always be a new enemy. There's always a new thing for us to fight.
Yeah.
We've destroyed that enemy. Here's another one. It's cliffhanger drama. It's the answer will be coming. The answer will be coming. It's throwing a stick for a dog. You hold it, you hold it, hold it, and then you occasionally throw it, but you never really throw it. And it's just a way of getting attention. You realize what they're doing. He attracts the biggest crowd by leaving a blank. And that blank will be filled by their suppositions. And the moment you get that brilliant, God, one of the best scenes in comedy, of them inventing the religion on the fly with the gourd and the sandal, that Milligan's in. Milligan's in the middle of that, watching possibly Python's high point in terms of thinking.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, he's left speechless, because I think he's watching them do something he couldn't do, which is to articulate that feeling of madness. And the achievement, I think, of Brian is to have an articulate response to life not making sense, whereas Milligan's joy is an inarticulate response to not making sense. That's an incredibly articulate scene, and I'm going to put my hand up and say Gwen Taylor in that, throughout the film, is amazing. But I didn't realise that was...
Yeah.
I asked someone on Facebook, I said, who's the woman with the Tina Weymouth accent and Tina Weymouth haircut? And someone, it's Gwen Taylor. I went, you are kidding. I thought it was some unnamed American actress they hadn't given credit to, but it's Gwen Taylor choosing an accent, so because she's playing 11 parts in this, always sensational.
Well, that's the thing as well. I'll come back to Spike in a moment because we need to talk about Spike. But I mean, in this film, unlike Python, largely in the past, there's a number of roles played by actual real women.
Yeah, and they're all really good,
and not just Carol Cleveland.
Isn't it nice? You keep thinking, boys, this works fine. You should have just been quite happy for this, because they're great. And it's not just Tarty and McNaughton has picked up in a Scottish bar. It's genuinely, all of whom are lovely in Python, but you tend to go, you could have some really good female comic actors in it, because they're brilliant. And Sue Jones-Davis is amazing, and Carol's brilliant in this. But and Gwen Taylor, who is just an asset to anything. I didn't recognise her. I thought they'd uncredited a major player, but she is holding her own in any scene where she's up against the Pythons. And obviously Cleveland is brilliant, but I think Gwen Taylor is your missing, if you wanted to keep naming her, eighth Pythons and ninth Pythons. She, in those scenes, carries the logic and the energy and the comic invention as well as any of these boys who are amongst the best sketch actors we've ever had. And she is so good. She's not just Chastity and Mrs. Mountbatten and the Ruttles. She is so good. And that slight American twang that gives it a sudden resonance about sort of fundamentalism in America that it wouldn't have otherwise. She's chosen that beautifully, just to differentiate it from other characters, I think. She's unrecognizably brilliant in that. And that bit where they're swapping how they're going to build a religion out of nothing. She's up there at the same heightened level as Cleese and Palin, and she's brilliant. All of them do a brilliant job there, and it nails the core of the film that you've made a religion out of nothing.
Yeah.
And you start saying, oh, that's not just religion. What other things do I believe that I have no evidence for? I just filled a gap.
Yeah. Well, so briefly, just on Spike, because obviously he's only in it for a minute, if that, on screen.
He's in it for slightly longer than George Harrison.
Yeah, we'll come to George in a minute as well. But Spike was on holiday. Well, he was kind of on holiday visiting World War II sites.
Yes.
For research, for his memoirs. Yeah.
Yes, of course. It's the Desert Campaign, of course.
Yeah, and he was there with his then girlfriend or partner, Sheila.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Pythons just said, look, come and film a bit. And he was happy to do so. And it was, I suppose it was kind of a homage to include him.
Yeah. And also bear in mind, he'd said some sort of cruel things about them nicking everything, which
he's gone on record and said he admires Python.
I think this is what is nice about this. It's another thing that says, let us not fight anymore. The internecine differences between the goons and Python, we can lay down arms. It's a lovely moment. You go, you want to feel that continuity, and you know how much it would have meant to the Pythons that he was there, because they were all admirers of him.
Well, I heard, and I don't know if you've heard this, and I think it's probably codswallop. I heard that Spike had also given them some money for this film.
Oh. Oh, that'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
I'd like to think he had. Probably a drop in the ocean compared to George Harrison, but still.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I think spiritually, this is the one that's doing something that you throw money at. That's why George Harrison's doing it, because he wants to laugh. But I think this is about something that those sort of people would believe in. This is about something that says, we were brought up on all these myths, and I want you to take them down. That is very much where Milligan is at that dismantling of icons.
Yes.
Is something he would think is important. And I don't know enough about his attitude to religion. Maybe I'm being dumb here, but I think he would have liked the questioning would have been important to him. So if it's true, I love the idea he gave money to this.
Yeah. If it's true.
Because I think looking back at what Life of Brian represents, I think it represents a watershed in our national deference to religion and a rediscovery that we must take the piss out of it. And it's one that I think we as a country managed very well through this. And looking back on it, we now know it's our best comedy film. We love it. Oh, good. So we're not America. It's a break with us being a religious country. It's a break with us being a country that allows and enjoys and celebrates religion, but also isn't afraid to laugh at it. I think it's important for us. I would imagine that was important for Spike to say, nothing's off limits with this kind of stuff. We want to be able to make jokes about our culture. This is our culture.
We should have something like that now, shouldn't we? We need something like that now, I think.
You need to. There's something. The version of this now, which is really interesting. Naomi Klein pointed out, said that corporate ownership of stuff and clamping down corporate interests, clamping down things, means you can't question the culture you have to live in.
Mm.
If I can't wake up and do a really good, if I can't say the words Mickey Mouse in a spoof, if the defensive parody, which only recently came in this country, if we don't have defensive parody, then people protect their brand. And the funny thing about this is it feels a little bit like the church was protecting its brand. You don't do the cross is our trademark, you've nicked it. And it's, but you have to be able to do a sketch on TV with a blue police box and not be sued by BBC Worldwide. You have to be able to, Naomi Klein said, the world now wants you to wake up every morning, the first thing you think of to be Superman or Mickey Mouse, but you not be allowed to say anything about it without paying somebody. And that's very different than authors' residuals and rights and copyright. That's saying we will not allow discussion of the culture we insist is the core culture of your country. And Life of Brian, I think, is a major blow for saying you have to be able to discuss your culture. And your culture is in a Christian country, or with these boys who've been to Christian schools, they have to be allowed to mock it. Or at least say, look at it.
Question it.
And that, I think, is very Milligan. What Milligan was doing with the military, Milligan was doing myths of British exceptionalism, with all the stuff that's in The Goons that he doesn't take seriously, government, and this is what Peter Cook's doing by doing an impression of Harold Macmillan. This is all part of a journey they've been on since Milligan, since the war, of saying, these guys have got feet of clay and we turn them down one at a time. And it feels like maybe Life of Brian, the last pillar that hadn't been taken down, the last pillar of the establishment that no one had been allowed to do. Private Eye had done journalism, and Beyond the Fringe had done politics, and Milligan had done the military, and religion was the last one that said, we can't touch that because we've got a special law, the blasphemy laws. And then, as Jones pointed out brilliantly, it's not blasphemous, it's heretical. And that's fantastic, because, yeah, without heresy, you don't get the Church of England. Perfect defence, and a historian's defence. Really, really clever.
And just quickly back to Milligan.
Because
he filmed in the morning, that scene, and he had lunch with them, and then they planned to use him in the afternoon, but he just disappeared.
So, he was taken up.
And Palin basically said that he'd really enjoyed doing it, but he was getting a little bit testy about the number of takes that Jones was making them do. So
amazing. Yeah. Well, you get the feeling from Q that he's not a man who does many takes.
No.
Take the shoes and follow him.
Stop.
Let us back. Yea, he cometh to us like the siege of the grave.
I love that Jones does many takes, which is why we have those long, long, uncut bits of performance, because you get that by rehearsing the hell out of those people and then doing lots of takes and then just leaving it to run. Watching it this morning, you can watch it if you've heard the jokes a million times. Watch it for the direction. I don't think Jones ever directed better, and I don't think anyone directed comedy that well before. I don't think there's many better directed comedy films. It's cut to the joke, but there's still loads of room for that Gilliam-esque. There's a joke in the set. There's room for that. It doesn't overburden it. It doesn't slow it down. It goes like a rocket. It's 1 hour 33. It's loads and loads of space for performance. When you're tired of the jokes, just watch them. Watch these guys at the peak of their powers just performing, and the fact that Jones has pointed the camera at them, framed them, and let them make each other laugh, which is why Biggest Diggus is regarded as a great scene, because it's the moment it cracks and you go, well, that's pure Milligan cracking up on screen. How much fun is that corpsing?
Absolutely. There's a couple of other people I just want to mention as well.
Yeah.
So we've got the stoning scene where you've got the little old man, Matthias, son of Deuteronomy of Gath. Now, I didn't know until I checked. The actor that played him, John Young, who was the actor who played Matthias, it was the old man opening the door at the PFJ headquarters to the Romans.
Found this spoon, sir. Found this spoon.
Yeah, he was also the guy who played the historian in Holy Grail.
Oh, God. Is he?
Yeah.
He's their rent an old man. That's fantastic. Yeah. It does feel like an extended ensemble cast. It feels like they've got the people they know who will work with this. So you've got your Gwen Taylors and your... They had their allies. Their
Ken Colley was in Ripping Yarns and Jabberwocky.
Yeah, and he's so lovely. Ken Colley's so good. He's fantastic. Admiral Ozzel up on the mountain. That's brilliant. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's got a nice little ensemble cast of people who can do this and they trust. To join them in the game.
Which of the Pythons is this isn't, I don't mean to sound negative, but in this film, in this film, say, because they all play multiple roles, who's the most one note in terms of the it's more or less the same sort of performance? Because I'm going to argue that it's Eric Idle.
Yeah, he's doing... The weird thing is at the end of it, when he's the guy singing the song on the crucifix, on the cross, I always thought when I was a kid that's Mr. Cheeky, and it isn't. It's singing Eric Idle. It's a different guy.
That's right.
Because he's got his long hair. He's doing a lot of his guys who could be a minder who are doing a deal. He's doing a lot of his dodgy businessmen. A little bit East End, a little bit Wide Boy.
The nudge guy.
Paul Whitehouse characters.
Yeah.
He's doing a lot of plasterers down the pub. For years, Eric was my favourite Python for donkey years because I just like the wordiness. And I love that character. I love the confidence of that character, that cockiness. And Mr. Cheeky is off the chart. One of the best things he ever did. That is such a funny idea. I love the fact that this is a film that doesn't take the story of Christ serious. No, it doesn't take religion seriously, and it doesn't take Hollywood epic seriously. And one of the problems the Romans have got is that no one takes their occupation seriously. And that puts it alongside things like To Be or Not to Be by Boris Lubitsch.
Yep.
It is the cheeky people who were rebelling against the authority. So it's got, I imagine, if you were in 1979, and for any reason, you smuggled a copy of this out to a Soviet place or behind the Iron Curtain, or if you were anywhere that was, you'd go, yeah, this is it. This is the little man who cheeks the big soldier. It's totally that attitude. No one's taking them seriously. They are, and it takes the sting out of it. It occurred to me as well how clever it is. They keep saying crucifixion, it's nothing special. And that means that by the time you get to the end of it, you're not where you are in Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth, where you think this is the most painful and horrible thing that can happen to someone, the key of Christianity's message. But you are able to laugh because you know these people don't take it seriously.
Mr. Cheeky, that character who's in it from the right at the beginning, he sort of bookends it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He will say anything in the service of a joke.
Yeah.
But he seems to have like this self-imposed code of conduct that he has to admit to it afterwards.
Yeah. Sorry. It's a lovely, I mean, it's just, yeah. And that's one of Eric's best voices, I think, is that tone, that naughty.
Yeah.
Also, he's very good at people you would hate to be trapped in a lift with.
Yeah.
And it's just that thing, you go, it's an office bore. That's a completely relatable thing. It's the guy who everything's a joke with. He's the Colin Hunt,
yeah.
Yeah. And everyone's been trapped with that guy. He's the life and soul of the party. It'd be dead without him, but God, just give it a rest.
Crucifixion?
Yes.
Good. Out of the door, line on the left, one cross each. Next. Crucifixion?
Yes.
Good. Out of the door, line on the left, one cross each. Next. Crucifixion?
No, freedom.
Mm-hmm. What?
Freedom for me. They said I hadn't done anything so I could go free and live on an island somewhere.
Oh, well, that's jolly good. Well, off you go then.
Nah, man, you're pulling your leg. It's crucifixion, really.
Oh, I see. Very good, very good. Well, out of the door.
Yeah, another way. Out the door, one cross each, line on the left.
Line on the left, yes. Thank you. Crucifixion?
Yes.
Good.
You mentioned the crucifixions, Zeffirelli, the Jesus of Nazareth, and obviously they used a lot of the sets from that. I haven't seen Jesus of Nazareth for many, 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 many years.
No, I don't think I've seen it since it was on.
Yeah.
I watched it when it was on. Yeah.
When I was a kid, and I can't remember. Because obviously in this film, the crucifixions are done with ropes. They're lashed.
But they've also got, I noticed this time for the first time, because it always bothered me, they've also got something in their hand. So I think you just don't see the nails go in. I think they're lashed to security and then nailed.
Oh, really? Right.
I always thought, and I was watching quite a nice print of it, and I thought, actually, no, I can see. Maybe on VHS I couldn't see it. There's a little prop in the palm of their hand. So I think what they do is they don't show it to you because it would ruin the joke. Yeah. But I don't think there's any doubt that they've been nailed. Some sense into them is they are nailed up.
Okay.
But you don't need to say, I think it would spoil the tone of it. But it is important that they're all laughing and joking up there, because it means that even the ultimate punishment, death is life's a laugh and death's a joke. It's true. You need to stop people thinking about what it actually means in order for the message of the comedy at the end of it to work. I think it would be, and obviously there's nothing about Python that's ever sort of not shown blood. You saw the Black Knight and you've seen organ transplants. Mm. Salad Days, they're happy to show it.
Yeah.
They chose not to show it because it would spoil the enjoyment of the end of it. And the end of it is that you can't dent these people's spirit, which is the message why they're singing it. You can't dent these people's spirit even by threatening them with death, because death is meaningless too, because they've said there's no narrative, there's no story. They haven't robbed anyone of any great story they were going to have. They're just people. We all die. And it's a very cynical, nihilistic, but weirdly hopeful to say, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you, at the beginning of it, Brian is looking for a great narrative, a great story. I must do something. At the end of it, it was all a waste of time. But hey, I mean, who cares? If he'd been part of the Suicide Squad, it would have been meaningless as well.
Yeah.
Even when Reg puts a narrative on him and says, "You're a martyr to the cause," and the dude says, "Here's your narrative." He goes, "This is no fun. You've given me the narrative, and the narrative was bullshit.
You bastard."
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's very funny. It's an extremely dark and funny joke, that. But it's darker than I think it's funny that people get nailed up, which would be the version if you saw the nailing. Mm. It's more of an existential joke for you to just go, there's death at the end of it, as there is for all of us.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, people get trying to put a narrative on it and say, here's the story we're giving you. And you're like, this isn't the story I wanted. But it is the one he asked for at the beginning. He wanted... It's got the same ending as The Wicker Man, isn't it? And I give you a martyr's death.
Yes.
He's an innocent who goes off and is sacrificed for someone else's beliefs. It's basically The Wicker Man again.
It's but, a slightly more upbeat end, though, generally, than The Wicker Man, still.
They both end with a song. Everyone seems very happy. It's fine.
just on that, so, look, I don't want to be that guy, right? But, you know, because impact gets lessened by repetition, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And are you... Right. I mean, I quite liked Always Look on the Bright Side of Life when I first heard it. And
yeah,
I think it entered the charts off the back of the Channel 4 showing in the early 90s. Are you know people who want Always Look on the Bright Side of Life to be played at their funeral?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that say that. And I think they're generally the kind of people who like Clarkson or will stand up at the front of the bus talking to the driver. You know, those sort of people.
It's escaped its context,
yeah,
which is not its fault. I watched it this time around deliberately. I knew it was coming. I went, I am going to listen to this again like I've never heard it before. And the context of the film is absolutely superb. Out of context, it's a little bit annoying, I think.
Mm.
But that's not its fault. But its ubiquity has robbed it of its rebelliousness. It's a victim of its own success. It is really good. It sums the film up and the themes. It's great. It's a lovely bit of work.
It is.
Nice arrangement.
It is.
Not as good a film as... It's not as good a song as Brian.
Brian.
Brian's incredible. Brian never gets old.
She was 16, the girl that sang that.
Is it Sonia Jones? I'm trying to find out if she was Trevor Jones's daughter, who... John Dupre is the musician's union name of Trevor Jones, who's the arranger.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, unless there's something else going on, why else would there be a 16-year-old girl called Jones in the building? It might be his kid, possibly. I don't know. But yeah, but Sonia Jones, 16, when she did that, this pure Shirley Bassey impression.
Yeah, that, amazing.
But again, weirdly, sets out the tone for it, like the music for Holy Grail, and says, this is an epic. It has got a John Barry theme. And it's done with complete conviction. And it sells you that the whole of the theme of the film as it starts is in that first song, which is, we'll do a Hollywood epic about a man called Brian who is completely unremarkable, because that's what the lyrics say. There's nothing remarkable about him. At the end of it, the last song says, he looked for narrative and it was meaningless, but then, hey, we all knew that all along. You've got to accept it.
Yeah.
So thematically, you bookended it with two astonishing songs, one of which says the joke you need to get at the beginning, and one of which says the joke you need to get at the end. I don't think... I mean, actually, no, maybe you shouldn't get cross with people who have it at their funeral, because maybe it is the only thing that could be of any comfort at the end is that song. Maybe it does maybe. Work.
Maybe.
I'm going to forgive them. But yeah, I had to listen to it with special ears on this time. Yeah. Remember this was being an astonishing thing. Because it was.
I just wanted to ask about, because you mentioned George Harrison, and obviously he famously remortgaged his house, Friar Park, was it? To stump up the cash to get this made, because he wanted to watch it. He wanted to see it. That was which is brilliant. And I know, obviously, there's that very brief cameo where there's the ADR, hello.
Hello.
Now, is that just so stupid people realise that it's George Harrison?
I don't know. It's over the top of him saying, maybe in the... maybe it's okay. Maybe it's one take and they didn't quite catch it in the hubbub. Most of the time, I think, wouldn't you, if you know anything about filming, if you're filming quickly, you usually don't get stuff like that because there's a lot of noise about. So usually it's done in ADR. And then when it comes to ADR, you wouldn't notice the amount of ADR that Michael Palin's doing for Michael Palin, but you will notice the ADR that Michael Palin's doing for George Harrison. So it's probably there's quite a lot of ADR in this dialogue replacement they didn't catch on set because they're in a noisy outdoor place. But you don't notice it, but you notice that. Well, I don't know. Unless he said something else. We know that Cleese is overdubbed saying klutz. Because he didn't say klutz.
Yeah.
but most of the ADR will be seamless. There's some lovely overdubbing. I love Palin's overdubbing in I love Palin's overdubbing in Python. He's overdubbing Otto, isn't he? For the Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
Because Eric Idle's been removed with his Jewish Nazi, because that's problematic. And that's been cut for good reasons. It slows the story down. It's not great.
The thing I like as well is that if it hadn't been for this film, then we probably wouldn't have had, we wouldn't have had handmade films.
No.
And what would the British film industry have looked like in the 80s and 90s without handmade?
Yeah, really? We wouldn't have had water. It's an artist-friendly film. The thing about the Python's movies, certainly the first three, I don't know about the fourth one, the first three are all made through unusual routes. They are outsider films. They're made by, I don't know, investors, businessmen, musicians.
Yep.
They're not allowed. It's so funny that, because the Pythons were regarded as very, very naughty boys at the BBC. As I said recently, they did their job to a world-class standard and were told off. I find that hilarious. It keeps them at school so much that they would go, oh, you naughty boys. They're always naughty boys.
Yes.
And you go, but if they were making drama and they made the best drama in the world, they'd been congratulated for doing their job the best they can. They made the best comedy film of all time and they're still naughty. I love the fact that the film industry didn't want to make this film and didn't want to make Holy Grail. They're a huge success and they still have outsiderdom, and maybe that's the thing that maybe they lost as they became part of the establishment, is that for most of their career they are funded by fans. They're a crowd-funded enterprise.
Yeah.
And they're this massive, massive thing, but they are it's fans crowdfunding their efforts, and those fans happen to be other incredible artists. It's a union of artists, and you end up with people like, I don't know, it's a guitarist and Ray Cooper, it's a percussion guy from Elton John's bongo player. It's the maddest bunch of people who get together to make this.
Just to wrap up, last night, because I'm a Twitter whore, or X,
yes.
X, I'm sorry, we should be calling it now, but I did post a poll asking what the best Monty Python film was. Because there's four, really, isn't there?
Say there's four.
There's End Now, and there's Holy Grail, there's Life of Brian, and Meaning of Life. Yeah. And the result, there was 1,300 people voted. Life of Brian, 52%.
Oh, the sacred number.
That sacred number.
So we now have to leave Life of Brian. No.
Yeah. Holy Grail was 41%. Meaning of Life was rounding it up about 7%. And 1% for something completely different.
That's very unfair to that film. Isn't it? Quite like that. It's the introduction to Python for lots of people. There's some great versions of the sketches in that. But yeah, out of the four of them, yes, it's not going to be anyone's favourite, particularly not when there's Life of Brian. Maybe that's the achievement of Life of Brian. Life of Brian survives and probably outlasts even Flying Circus, which is my favourite iteration of Python, by being the one that shows them off their best. They needn't have made one of these. They could have left behind a reputation like, I don't know, Rowan and Martin's Laughing, that it's hard to tap back into. But they've left one behind that's really good.
Yeah. I favour slightly Holy Grail.
Yeah, me too. I think it's my favourite of the two. Just because I like... Also, because I love sketch comedy. And I like broken comedy. I like things that are just funny.
Yep.
My thing about Holy Grail is it wouldn't exist in any other medium. It's only a comedy. Whereas Life of Brian is also a pretty good, you could make a pretty good straight drama that asks these questions, which is why I think it transcends and is a great ambassador for their art. But yeah, Holy Grail is just stupid. I think, sketch for sketch, Holy Grail makes me laugh more. But Life of Brian is spectacular. What a sales pitch.
Absolutely. So Joel, listen, thank you Thank you so much for sparing a Friday afternoon to come and talk to me about this film.
What a nice thing to do. Yeah. I'm sorry, I suddenly found myself inspired by what it made me think, which is an exciting thing to do with a film you've seen so many times you think, I don't need to see this again. Maybe it's a reason to go back to some of your favourite things, so they might say something different to you now as you get older. It's great.
Okay, I better let you go. I've delighted you for too long. what are you working on? I mean, obviously, you've got the Be Funny or Die is due out next
that's
year.
But obviously, what you do in the meantime is you write a lot of scripts and you send them to people who then either say yes or no. It's that usual. Yep. I am, as I keep saying to people, I'm standing at the fruit machine with a bag full of coins and I keep feeding them in and then every so often it pays out and I put that money back in. Which is, I think I've worked out the life of the freelance writer. And I used to think it was more complicated than that, but I think all you're doing is making sure the bag of coins is still there. And I can understand that because I lived in amusement arcades as a kid. So I go, yeah, get that. So I'm currently feeding lots of coins into the machine. There's two or three projects I'm doing at the moment that I think are really lovely. I hope one of them goes before I run out of coins.
Brilliant. And more comfort blanket coming up?
Yes, I've taken a small break because I've been doing some band stuff. Releasing an album,
which is
Candidate is a new album. We haven't done one in 16 years, so we did that just as a thing inspired by lockdown. We wanted to do it, and that's come out. So I took a little break from Comfort Blanket while I sorted that out, and I'm doing these scripts. So Comfort Blanket's on a very, very slight hiatus while I finish these scripts, but two of the three of them are delivered. So, and I've got some really nice people who want to come and do it, so I'm going to phone them back and maybe this side or the other side of Christmas, we're doing a new load of comfort blankets. So that should be fun. But yeah, I've been pausing that because, as you know, otherwise you can easily fill your week with, as we have done, nattering about the stuff you love. And sometimes you have to go off and write. Otherwise you just talk about things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so this show will probably be taking a break in the new year. So,
well, good. Have some rest.
Yes.
Lay fallow. Let the field recover.
Yes. Brilliant. Joel, thank you so much. And
that was lovely.
And I hope that one day our paths cross again.
I can't wait. Lovely.